Well, thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. My presentation is a little different from the ones to date in that I don't have a regression analysis, but I do have a simulation model towards the end, so bear with me. And I'm situating gender inequality within the broader debates about inequality and also in the context of macroeconomic policies as well as labour market issues. Okay, so just to begin, a quote from Christine Lagarde, CEO of the IMF, who points out that gender inequality is a matter of justice as well as a question of basic economics. And I think keeping those two things in mind is quite important. And I also think it's, important to sort of recognise that there is a big institutional interest in inequality, although I think there are various limitations on the extent to which some of the orthodox thinkers tend to think about these issues. So I've organised the talk into three parts. First of all, just some general remarks about inequality, redistribution and pre-distribution. But I want to think about macro and micro dimensions of pre-distribution. I'm only going to speak about the gender pay gap. I'm not going to speak about gender poverty. But then I also want to think about austerity policies and their gender impact before turning to alternative policies for sustainable and more inclusive development. But just to begin, I just want to just to sort of highlight the scale of inequality, which is massive, and as I say, attracting the interests of world leaders such as Barack Obama, the Pope, as well as Christine Lagarde, and of course Thomas Piketty's book Capital was a bestseller in the United States, highlighting the huge increase in inequality in the last few years. Christine Lagarde was at an inclusive capitalism conference in London in 2014, and she asked the question about Karl Marx and whether capitalism contained the seeds of its own destruction, or whether something called inclusive capitalism was possible, or whether it was an oxymoron. And her view is that it's not an oxymoron, that it is possible to have inclusive capitalism, and that it is possible to secure trust, opportunity, and rewards for all within a market economy, provided one has effective tax policies, and that there are measures to increase women's empowerment and agency. Amongst those at the Inclusive Capitalism Conference, she was one of the few to talk about gender equality, so you know, it's a sort of positive there. As I'm saying, that there are this institutional interest in, sorry, wrong way. There is this institutional interest in inequality, but it depends very much on an integration within a market economy. And I think it's quite important to recognise the way that economic policies do contain social content. It's not just that they have social outcomes that may be untoward. They actually embed social content, which reflects some inequalities, which also have an important gender aspect, about which I'll say more later on. So it's important to think about overall inequality, the kind of policies that create that, and in the context of the European Union, to recognise that although it has all the gender strategies that you can imagine since, you know, and has done for 50 years, it also has the Growth and Stability Pact, which makes the policy intentions and aspirations of the gender equality policies more difficult. And I don't think that sort of potential contradiction is always appreciated. So just to think about inequality. I've got a Mr. Slide out here. I was just going to highlight the ways in which Thomas Piketty talks about the rise of inequality in the 1970s, largely being due to a rise of wage inequality. He points out that during that time, the marginal rate of income tax on high incomes fell, There's a sort of almost a correlation there between the rising incomes and the fall in tax rate. If you look at a more European dimension, though, it's also important to note that there's been a big wage dispersion, and that the employment conditions, especially for people lower down the wage profile, now have much more insecure working conditions than they have before. This varies between countries considerably, and is particularly high in the neoliberal, flexible, about to leave EU UK, which I hope doesn't happen. But anyway, there we go. In terms of these levels of inequality, then Thomas Piketty proposes that there be a global wealth tax and a more steeply progressive income tax. And he likes these methods because tax increases is a relatively liberal way for reducing inequality, because it enables free competition and private property to be respected, while private incentives are modified in potentially radical ways. So it's sort of limited. So he would be very much for redistribution once the market has come to various outcomes. Though in thinking about the way that there has been this rise of inequality in recent years, he attributes it very much to the rise of top incomes, and he doesn't find any rational explanation for that rise in top incomes except social norms that make them possible. And I think in contrast to his approach, if you read the OECD report in 2008, quite an older one now on inequality, but I think what they say there is really interesting, because they argue that the only way to reduce inequality is to stop the underlying widening of wages. And that's a sentence with the word stop in, as if, you know, you could just do that. Clearly, it's not an easy thing to do. But what I do think is important is to recognise, you know, as I was saying, that the inequality, wage inequality, has increased, and you know, there's not much rational explanation for it. And as Thomas Piketty points out, rather than reflecting higher marginal productivity, the wealth of contemporary elites reflects their power to set their own remuneration. And this is constrained only by social norms. And in a different paper, Paul Krugman also talks about the role of social norms in influencing wage inequality. And I think it's important to recognise that these social norms are also gendered social norms. And, you know, when one reflects on some of the processes leading to the low wages in those jobs and occupations occupied predominantly by women, the explanation for them is actually quite hard to find. I mean, one can, and I'll show that the one can try to work on a rational explanation in a moment, I'll talk about that in a bit more detail in relation to care work. But before I do so, I want to just think about the enduring these slides have got a bit out of order. The enduring character of gender inequality, and so to think about the gender pay gap to begin with, and then to move on to thinking about social norms and wage determinations before talking about austerity policies. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the gender pay gap in the UK. This is an issue that affects many European countries at the moment, and the UK has come up with some policy recommendations which are interesting but rather limited in my view. So the UK has a very high gender pay gap relative to other countries. This is on an hourly basis at 19.2%. But if you start differentiating by different sections of the population, if you only look at those working more than 16 hours a week, it's only 16%. If you exclude mothers, it's only 10%. And if you're both working 16 hours a week and are not a mother and aged between 22 and 35, then the pay gap is much, much lower still. So recognizing those different dimensions of the pay gap is quite important when it comes to thinking about policy measures at that level. What's also interesting is, when adjusted for education, only the least well-educated groups have experienced any decline. And that's in part linked to the decline of male wages rather than an increase in female wages. And for the more educated, there's not been much evidence of a decline in the gender pay gap for the last 20 years. And so, you know, as other people have argued this morning, overall the gender pay gaps reflects occupational gender segregation and the higher pay in occupations where men dominate. It's also, that's where the gender pay gap is highest in the UK, and I believe that's the case in other countries. And that's, in a sense, why there is this focus on the pay gap in high levels and getting more women into senior positions. But I also think it's important to recognise that it's a sort of truism, not so many people work there. And so if you want to address the gender pay gap as a whole, it's also important to address low pay at the bottom in order to be able to have some effect there. And then the second key determinant of the gender pay gap is the differential employment status of women and men between full and part-time work, which, of course, as people have said this morning, reflects the uneven division of domestic labour. And the other thing in the UK, which is something to take into account, this is something which varies between countries. In the UK, the cost of childcare is very high. OECD estimate that it's 40% of a standard couple's income compared to an average in the OECD of only 17%. So there's a real disincentive for women on low earnings to work, as the marginal benefits from so doing are somewhat lower. So even though the gender pay gap is quite small at the lower level, the fact that the earnings are low relative to the costs of working mean that it's not done. However, we have hope on the horizon because in 2015, David Cameron announced his plans to end the gender pay gap in a generation. The government are introducing a number of policies in order to try to do this. But a lot of the policies are very limited. They just relate to reporting what the gender pay gap is. The other measure they're thinking of adopting, which is was mentioned this morning, is encouraging more women to move into STEM subjects, more girls to take up STEM subjects at school. However, it's important to recognise that 40% of women with STEM qualifications don't work in STEM sectors in the UK. So, the problems are not simply the qualifications that people get, but the conditions of working in sectors where, in those particular sectors. The other thing is that although the gender pay gap is lower in those sectors, so it seemed to be another argument for moving women into them, the dynamic effects of that movement are not really being considered. And generally, as sectors become more feminized, then pay tends to fall. So the Women and Equalities Unit, the regulations which have been passed are for reporting, and they're more radical than those originally proposed, in that companies above 250 people will have to report the mean and median gender pay gap across all employees, but also the gender distribution in different pay quartiles, which I think is quite interesting because this will reflect on the differential positioning of women and men within organisations. It will also have information on bonuses, which are quite important in the UK context, the difference in the amount of bonuses received and the difference in the proportion of women and men receiving bonuses. It's really about reporting, not necessarily doing anything about any of these things on the grounds that naming and shaming companies will have some impact. It's not clear. The Women and Equalities Unit, which is a cross-parliamentary unit, have been quite critical of the proposals to date and have suggested rather more important measures. These include making all jobs flexible. Going back to the discussion this morning, thinking about part-time and full-time work, actually making high-level jobs available on a part-time basis. When I've done interviews with employers, they're very sceptical about this. However, I would suggest the potential is greater than is often perceived. I mean, nobody works 24/7, 365 days a year, and therefore, in a sense, all jobs are part-time. So, thinking about organising work differently, I think there's, given we can put people on the moon and all sorts of things, I'm sure it must be feasible to think about organising work in ways that do not require one-to-one attention from a senior manager at the drop of a hat or the drop of a, instantly. The danger with that approach is, of course, that people who are working part-time will still experience the idea that they're not fully committed. So it may or may not work. It may increase opportunities. Certainly, there's an economic inefficiency in that a large proportion of women, including those 40% in STEM areas not working in STEM, a lot of talent is clearly being wasted. And then parental leave, which we've discussed, but recognising that this has to be non-transferable in order to work. And then the strategy I like is this one about an industrial strategy for low-paid, highly feminised sectors to improve productivity and pay levels. Now, I think it's very important to improve pay levels, but increasing productivity in some sectors where women work can be rather perverse. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. And then also pathways to women to return to work. Feminists and NGOs, including the Women's Budget Group, of which I'm a member, they want a greater attention concerned about low pay in sectors where women, especially BME women, black minority ethnic women, are overrepresented, and also being attentive to the high costs of childcare. And as far as the UK is concerned, the gender pay gap is high, partly because the overall dispersion of incomes is earnings is very high. And sometimes measures which are not gender specific can be gender more effective. For example, raising the minimum pay level, which the government have done, but not by very much. We now have the new living wage, which arguably is not enough to live on, depending where you are and so on. And the political commitment in the UK seems to be more towards women at the top rather than across the distribution as a whole. Now, I want to come back to this question. So I think you need a holistic strategy that considers all these things, care provision, employment segregation, low pay, working time regulations, gender stereotypes, gender bias, conscious and unconscious. There's a lot of attention to unconscious gender bias, which influences the demand for people in the UK at the moment. And I think that's critical rather than looking at the gender pay gap in isolation. But I'm just going to do two more things. One is to think about the question of social norms and wage determination, and then turn to the more macro level. So if you think about social norms and wage determination, what really determines wages? This is a question which I think, economists need to pay more attention to when you look at some of the huge pay gaps that exist. And I just pick on childcare work as an example, because that relates to the simulation model that I'll talk about in a moment. Huge difference, the average wage of a childcare worker with 20 years of experience is about 19,000 euro, given the way the pound is falling at the moment. And that compares with, it's much lower than the average wage. But if you look at what the top managers, the super managers, as Thomas Piketty would call them, are earning, they would only need to work for something like 1.5 days to earn the same amount that a childcare worker works all year. And then if you think about it, what is the value of the output of those two workers respectively? Is it really marginal productivity? Well, I personally think not. And I realise this is a difficult question. How do you address social norms? But, they haven't always been this degree of difference, and in different countries they vary. So it's quite important to sort of pay some attention to the question of social norms. And it can't just be linked to productivity, because, from an economic point of view, care work is not a normal good. It's relational, it's always, you know, between parties, and therefore the quality is quite hard to assess. It's rival, so if I'm looking after you people, imagine your toddlers for a moment, I could probably only cope with two. The government in the UK had the idea of trying to increase the number of childcare children looked after by childcare workers to six. And so a Guardian columnist, Zoe Williams, took a photograph of herself with six toddlers just to see how one would, in fact, manage. And it's clearly an impossible situation. I mean, they withdrew that request. But it's just to highlight the way in which there are certain areas of the economy where it's quite difficult, even perverse, to try to increase productivity. And it can't be done without changing the nature of the thing it is that you are providing. I mean, the technology can have some, make some steps, but not, it can't resolve everything where care matters. And this means that it tends to be done by people who experience various labour market disadvantage, migrants, women, ethnic and racial minorities, or by outsourcing, you know, with, as in the global care chain. And there are alternatives. And, you know, there was a paper that I read as a student years and years and years ago by William Beaumont about the question of it was called The Macroeconomics of Unbalanced Growth, talking about those sectors where productivity cannot increase, but wages will increase a bit in line with productivity increases elsewhere in the economy, simply because you can't hold wages down to a very, very low level. But his point is, and he's, you know, wrote a book with someone else in 2012, which reflects back on his early theorizing and said, more or less says, yes, I was right. I mean, his point is that, you know, the reason for the increased cost in these kinds of industries is because of productivity increases elsewhere in the economy. And therefore, it's a distributional question rather than one of anything else. Right. So I want to turn now to macroeconomic policies and very quickly just to highlight the way that, you know, that debt is a, how you deal with debt, the size of debt, how you choose to finance it is a political question rather than a technical necessity. So, you know, if you imagine that area there, which looks like a kite, is the government's fiscal space, that there are different ways of financing it. And, you know, how you finance it has important distributional consequences. As Tom R. Piketty again argues, debt is not a question of absolute wealth, but one of distribution. Europe has the highest level of wealth per capita in the world and the greatest difficulty in resolving its debt crisis. But what you can do is you can think about how, you know, by using gender auditing, gender budgeting, you can monitor the impact of the ways in which the debt crisis is being managed. And in the UK, it's had highly regressive effects. It's implemented very negatively on low-income groups and on women in particular. And in a longer paper, I illustrate that, but I don't want to highlight that too much. I'll just make that point and then come to the alternatives. And this reflects work I was doing with the Women's Budget Group. We were commissioned to do this work by the International Trade Union Congress, which was to think about alternatives to austerity. And of course, the straight Keynesian alternative is for investment, public sector investment. And what we did was we looked at investment in social infrastructure compared to physical infrastructure. And so we did a simulation model of looking at 2% of GDP to be invested either in the care sector or in the construction industries. So by care, we're talking about elder care and child care. And we looked at the impact. And of course, if you recall from your input-output studies, when you make an investment, it has a direct effect on employment in the sectors where it takes place, an indirect effect on the bits and pieces you use to carry out that primary employment, and then you have induced effects from consumption in the workers, from the workers who otherwise might have been unemployed. So you have the direct, the indirect, and the induced effects from increased consumption. And looking at that, we find that The number of jobs created is considerable, and that it's, if you, construction is on the far side, furthest away from me, and care on the near side, and you see that the jobs created by investment is, any investment is significant, but the jobs created in care is far greater than in construction. And the really interesting thing is that when you invest in care rather than construction, the number of jobs overall is greater, the number of jobs for women is greater, but the number of jobs for men is not that much smaller. So men gain from investment in social care by the indirect and induced effects, even though they're low, more not so represented in the sector itself. And therefore, this provides a way of challenging austerity, of providing care which is needed, incredibly needed in the UK, both for elderly people and for children. And potentially, if that level of investment took place, it would have a positive impact on wages and conditions in that sector. So to conclude, gender inequality is both inefficient and socially unjust. At the micro level, it's important to think about wage determination, and at the macro level, to think of counter-austerity policies, but to recognise that investment in care is a form of investment, not a social cost. Thank you.